This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch our TV show on Free Speech TV and on our website. A majority of Americans are experiencing shock, anger, and disgust at the way in which our new president's first week in office has unfolded. The lies and hypocrisy, the fixation on crowd sizes, the war with the media, and the diplomatic disaster with Mexico have us cringing in collective shame. But in a report from a small town in Michigan, the Guardian newspaper on Friday reported that Trump's popularity among his core supporters was still strong, and that many of them did not consider his first week a disaster at all. In fact, they were quite impressed. How does Trump do it? Joining me to help answer that is George Lakoff. He's a professor at the Graduate School in Cognitive Science and Linguistics at University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Center for the Neural Mind and Society. He's written several books, including Don't Think of an Elephant, which was just republished, Moral Politics, The Political Mind, and many more. Welcome to the program, George.
Always a pleasure, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, how is it that we seem to have these two different versions of reality that, one sort of faction in the United States, broadly speaking, is experiencing, and another faction is experiencing what seems to be the opposite?
Well, about 20 years ago, back when I wrote Moral Politics, I pointed out that there were two different worldviews out there, and I described what they are. And once you see them, you'll understand who Trump's supporters are and who Trump is and what he's doing and why, and that he is really within the mainstream of conservative Republican politics. That's something that's not obvious, and there's a lot of things about him that are real but not obvious, and we should discuss them. What I found out when I started looking into this back in 1994, when the Contract with America came out. And the Contract with America was a book put out by Newt Gingrich and written by Frank Luntz that was for candidates in the 94 election, and they won that. They took over Congress. And what they said was this: if you elect us, we're going to do the following 10 things. We're going to get rid of abortions. We're going to impose a flat tax. We're going to get rid of environmental regulations. We're going to make sure you can all own guns, and so on. And they went on like that. And I looked at that and I said, that's weird. What do these issues have to do with each other? Why do they come together, and why do they make sense to conservatives as coming together as being one thing? And I realized that was a problem in my field, cognitive science. And so I studied it. And it took a few months to figure it out. But I figured it out when I realized that there was a metaphor that we all have that's usually unconscious and taken for granted. The nation is family. We have founding fathers. We, have homeland security. We don't want missiles in our backyard. We send our sons and daughters to war, and so on. All of that means that we're understanding the nation in terms of a family. And then the question is, what kind of family? Does it matter? And I started looking at the focus on the family literature on the right wing. And they were very clear about it. It is a strict father family, very different from the kind of nurturant parent family that I was used to and that I had. And a nurturant parent family, which is actually the basis of progressive politics, you have the following idea. You're supposed to communicate and understand your children and empathize with them to know what they need. You want them to be fulfilled in life. You want them to get an education, to be healthy, to be strong, and to be able to take care of themselves and others. And you want them to grow up, to be able to be empathetic and be both socially and personally responsible. That is normal progressive parenting. And it turns out that when you look at the studies of child development, it is one of the best forms of progressive parenting. Now, what this does politically, when you map it onto politics, because we're all first governed in our families, you have a notion that all governing institutions are families. So a progressive view of politics says that citizens care about other citizens. This is a politics of care. We work through our government to provide public resources for everybody, resources that allow you to be fulfilled in life, to be free, to be recognized as with respect, and so on. This is just part of normal America, and in fact, it's been there since the founding of the country. It also works for both business and private individuals. Now, and we can go into that if you like, but the other view is what I'll call a strict father view. It says father knows best. Father is the authority in the family, and he knows right from wrong. And this is very important in politics because all politics is moral. If someone says, do what I say, here's my policy, the assumption is that it's right, not wrong. That's why these moral views matter so much. And if you have opposite policies, you're going to have opposite moral views. So in a strict father family, the father says, hey, I have to raise my children and make sure my spouse, has the right views of things. And and they're supposed to follow me because I know right from wrong. I know what's moral. So if the children don't do what I say, then I have to punish them. It's called tough love. It's because I love them and want them to be moral beings, I have to punish them.
So in this view, Trump is a strict father. I mean, his supporters see him as someone who knows best for them. And if that is the case, how do they view the media? I mean, you finally do have the New York Times and you have the Washington Post actually being very bold about calling out Trump's lies. How does that play out amongst Trump supporters? Are they able to simply dismiss these publications as being sure. exaggerating?
Well, let me explain, because you need to know a little bit more about how this works. In the strict father morality, there's a logic, and the logic is that if a child obeys his parent and doesn't do what feels good, but does what, what the parent says is right, then the child will become disciplined. And if they're disciplined, they can go out in the world and become prosperous. Now, what happens if they're not prosperous? That means they can't be disciplined, which means they can't be moral, and hence they deserve their poverty. Hence the view that poor people are lazy and deserve their poverty. But you get much more out of this, and this is where it gets really important. You have the idea that authority and morality come together naturally in the world. And the way you can tell this, since the assumption is that the world works this way, is that you look at who has become out on top to determine a hierarchy of who is better than who. So you have a notion that religion has done well. So you have God above man above nature. We're there to conquer nature, to use nature for what we want. You have the idea of the strong above the weak, the rich above the poor, employers above employees, adults above children. In 21 states, teachers and coaches can beat children with sticks, if they don't show respect. Then you have Western culture above non-Western culture. We beat out the non-Western cultures. You have America above other countries, and then it goes personal. You have things like men above women, whites above non-whites, Christians above non-Christians, straights above gays. That is that hierarchy, and that hierarchy determines just about all conservative positions on just about every issue.
So you can't counter with facts and truth.
Exactly, for the following reason. First of all of this is unconscious and automatic. One thing you learn from neuroscience is that about 98% of thought is unconscious, and you don't have conscious access to those thoughts. All thoughts are physical. They're there in your neural circuitry. Thoughts don't float in the air. They're there in your neural circuitry. And once they're fixed and learned, you can only understand and make sense of what your neural circuitry allows you to. If your brain can't make sense of it, it's not going to be sensible. So what you have are two very different views. Now, there are lots of people, moderates are people who have mostly one and partly the other, and there are moderates on all sides, but they don't fit together. That is, if you're a conservative and you have some progressive views, they can be on all kinds of different issues. So this is a very important thing to understand about how this works. So if you are a person who has a strict father view of the world or a nurturant view of the world, if you're a progressive, you have a nurturant view of the world, your very personal identity, your personal identity is bound up with who you are morally, because you think of yourself as doing right, not wrong. You don't think of yourself as going around doing evil. Nobody does, pretty much. Very few people do. And so what you have is a view of identity. So if you have a strict father identity, the most important thing for you is that the country and the world work by your view of identity. You want yourself to be respected as the true American.
So George, let's skip ahead to how one does make progress then, because from paying attention to the work you've done over the years, a lot of it is a matter of how we frame our issues. And you pointed out that during the election, Hillary Clinton really failed to point out what she was for, instead focusing on what she was against, which was Trump. And the more she featured Trump, the more actually support he got, because she simply showcased all of those things about him that her supporters might have found repugnant, but his supporters found quite popular. How do we reframe issues so that we really win over those Trump supporters with whom we might have much in common? I'm also thinking, for example, about the Affordable Care Act. 8 years ago, there was so much anger from this conservative Tea Party base about the Affordable Care Act. Probably many of those people are today using the Affordable Care Act and are angry about losing it, but 8 years ago they were angry about the government actually implementing it. So for progressive policies such as the Affordable Care Act, which could have been even more progressive, how do we reframe our issues so that Trump voters, with whom we have a lot in common, really do see the commonalities between us and them?
This is a great question and very important. There was a book written over a decade ago called What's the Matter with Kansas? That asked, why is it that poor people in Kansas vote against their material interests? And the answer is they vote for their moral and interests and for their identity. That's what's going on in these cases. And the lies don't matter. The idea is their view of morality and their identity is a deeper truth, a higher truth. And so the lies are in the service of a higher truth. So when they talk about alternative facts, what's an alternative fact? It is something that follows from their worldview. That's a consequence of it. And if the worldview is an ultimate truth, then whatever follows from it must be a fact, an alternative fact from an alternative view of the world. Now, this is crazy if you think about absolute facts in the world, which are there and true, but that's not how other folks think, and it's very important to understand it. But there are things you can do. The first thing to do is to understand what a moderate is. A moderate is somebody who is mostly progressive but conservative on some issues, randomly distributed, the same with conservatives who are partly progressive on some issues. And then there's a very important group of conservatives, people who have what I'll call in-group nurturance, who care about people in their group, and that group can vary. It could be in your church, where they try to help other people in their church. It could be in the military, where the military is a strict father enterprise, but on military bases, you get free child care, a place to live, free medical care, cheap prices at the PX, and in your military group, you never leave a wounded brother behind. This is in-group nurturance, but it extends also to neighbors, to your local community, to your region often. And when that happens, what happens is that you have a lot of conservatives who may politically have strict father views, but when it comes to, you know, a forest fire threatening their neighbors' homes, they'll be out there with the hoses. When it comes to a flood, they'll be swinging sandbags.
So when it comes to people they know, they're perfectly nice, but when it comes to people they don't personally know, they might see them as taking opportunities away from them, such as immigrants, women, etc.
You've got it, because those people are lower on the moral hierarchy.
Right.
They're lower on the moral hierarchy. Now, the next thing is the Democrats get virtually all of these things wrong because of the way they do polling and the way they think about issues. They think about issues issue by issue. They ask, what is your most important issue? Where the most, for conservatives, the issue is conservatism itself. You know, the whole idea of, you know, of what the world should be like.
Right.
But for liberals, they just go issue by issue, and that is a disaster. One, because they never say what it is that they believe deeply that's unconscious and automatic. Remember, 98% of thought is unconscious. Your deepest moral views are automatic. They're there. You just use them. You don't, you know, it's very hard to articulate them. So, you know, progressives don't do that. They don't articulate them, and they don't usually know them. But it gets worse when you do polling. And the reason is this. Polling is done first issue by issue. Second, it's done on the basis of demographics. So, you know, how much, what is your income? Are you married, not married? What is your ethnicity, etc.? Now, that's all from census data. They never ask what your values are, and they never ask questions that get at those deep values. We have ways of doing that. I have former students who have figured out how to do it and do polling in various places, largely in Europe, but in America too, where they the results are very different once you bring in values. But the Democrats don't do that. As a result, what happens when they go issue by issue is they will claim that most Americans agree with the Democrats on every issue. It's not true. And the reason it's not true is that the people surveyed as positive on each of those issues are not the same people. The people vary.
That's because individuals have a spectrum of views on a spectrum of issues, basically.
Exactly. So it's not the case that this goes over all Americans.
Right.
In each case, you can happen to get a majority by getting all Democrats, and those Republicans happen to go with that issue, and then it's a different group on the next issue.
So, George, Republicans and Trump are very good at using language to reframe the debates. For example, you know, Trump wants to get rid of regulations. They want to undermine entitlements. But if we rename those words as protections instead of regulations, as earnings instead of entitlements, which are actually more accurate, then all of a sudden they have a completely different meaning. Why don't more so-called liberal media learn to use those terms? Why do they end up using the language that conservatives have created?
Okay, that is a great question. Every regulation is there to protect somebody from unscrupulous corporations. The term regulation is from the viewpoint of the corporation.
Yeah.
It's something that takes away their freedom to do anything they want to anybody they want. You know, it is really a protection of the public. So when Trump says he wants to get rid of two-thirds of all the regulations, he's really saying we want to get two-thirds of all the protections of the public. You know, nobody says it. And there's a reason why the liberal press doesn't say it, and why the Democrats don't say it. And it's a very deep reason having to do with universities. I teach it. I spent 50 years teaching in universities. And it's been very frustrating for the following reason. If you are a conservative and you want to go to college, what are you going to study? Well, chances are you're going to take some business economics courses, and in that curriculum, you're going to take a marketing course. And in a marketing course, they'll tell you about advertising, and they'll tell you how people really think. People think in terms of framing, metaphors, narratives, emotions, images, and so on. That's how people really think, and that's how they sell products, right? And you hear every day on TV, and they make sure you know that you have to repeat, repeat, repeat. Why does repetition matter? Repetition matters because every time you hear a word that means something, it activates that meaning in your brain circuitry. Every time something is activated in your brain circuitry, it gets stronger. The circuit gets stronger. The synapses get stronger. I could go through the neuroscience if you really want to, but you probably don't. Basically, those circuits are getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And that's why the ads are the same over and over, and they get slogans. But the slogan isn't the idea. The idea is in your brain circuitry and includes emotions. Emotions are not separate from all that, but it's not mostly emotional. It has to do with framing, with understanding, and with the way you reason and get consequences. Now, this works for products, and conservatives have learned how to sell their ideas. And Trump is a master salesman. He's been selling for 50 years.
Yeah, if you read his biography, Trump, one of his biographies, Trump Revealed by the Washington Post, authors that we covered on our show. I mean, he's a hustler. He pits one group against another. He knows how to hustle. And he's been hustling the public through Twitter for years. And he continues through these 140-character statements to be able to set the stage, the agenda, and directly talk to his supporters and the American public. I understand that you have a, let's end with your analysis of the typical Trump tweets. How exactly does he used Twitter in a very interesting and manipulative way that I think most of us don't catch because we like to think he's kind of stupid.
He is not stupid. He is not, you know, people think that he's he gets angry and he gets emotional in the middle of the night and just throws out something random. It is not random. Every tweet is strategic. Every tweet is strategic, and there are four strategies. One, preemptive framing. You get the frame out there first powerfully to 31 million people. So, I only appeared to lose the popular vote because there was fraudulent voting, 500, huge numbers of people voted that were illegal, okay, or dead. Now, that's false, but the point is the idea is out there. It is said. Once it's said, the idea gets in people's minds. If it's repeated, as it will be, and it will be repeated by the press. Now, the thing he understands about the press is the press is addicted to what is called breaking news. And they take the tweets as breaking news. So that allows him to do preemptive framing, to get his frame out there first, and then it's amplified and repeated by the press, which makes it even stronger. So breaking news is taking the tweets as that is that. Another one is diversion. So at the time when there was an attack on his finances and whether it violated the Constitution, he goes and he tweets an attack on Meryl Streep. Well, what happens? Diversion. The press spends 3 days covering Meryl Streep, interviewing Meryl Streep, showing clips of Meryl Streep, debating Meryl Streep. You know, not debating the finances, not debating what's real. The next one is deflection. Very traditional thing. Kill the messenger. Attack the messenger. The messenger says the truth. Attack the messenger. That's the attack on the press. And so if you attack the messenger enough, it says anybody who disagrees with me is going to be telling you falsehoods.
Right. I mean, Steve Bannon, his chief strategist, former Breitbart head, simply told the media to shut up. The news media should just shut up. Wow.
Well, exactly. But, you know, he just says it's crooked, crooked, crooked. Nobody is crooked as the media, etc. You know, and repeats it, repeats it, repeats it, frames it that way, and attacks the messenger. The last one, the fourth, is the trial balloon, where you suggest something to see what the public reaction is. So, for example, he tweeted that we should take nuclear weapons more seriously. And, you know, why do we have nuclear weapons if we don't use them, and so on? Everybody, you know, or, you know, et cetera, should have nuclear weapons, right? Now, the question is, when you have a trial balloon, you're saying, what is the public going to do? Who's going to react to that? Well, there was a reaction for a while. They interviewed some former secretaries of defense and so on for one day, and then it was gone. So he now knows that the public isn't going to care about this. Weirdly, could destroy the world, could create major wars, could kill God knows how many people, but the public isn't going to care. Hmm. Then you have, Kellyanne Conway doing her thing. Now, Kellyanne's an interesting person because she won't shut up. She just goes on and on with one thing after another. And what she does is she knows how to hold the floor. And this is important because in communication, communication is supposed to go back and forth between one person and another. But there are certain techniques for holding the floor and going on and not letting the other person talk. And those techniques use grammar. What they do is they use sentence structure in such a way that you never really end the sentence. So you're supposed to wait till the sentence ends, and she never ends a sentence. Right. She just goes on and on and on, you know. Occasionally they say, "I have to cut you off now," you know, go on to the next topic, rather than go on against what she said in this topic.
Right. So she's had her say, and she's basically won.
Won, and she's won just by grammar. But in addition to that, the lying is quite remarkable. The alternative facts are remarkable. And ignoring things is remarkable. For example, take the tax returns. She says, well, you know, you elected him. You show that the public doesn't care about tax returns. Therefore, we don't have to release them. Wait a minute here. The issue of tax returns is not just about taxes. We know he doesn't pay his taxes. Okay. But the issue is not about tax evasion. The issue is who he owes money to in Russia and other places and other countries. Now, if it turns out he is indebted to Putin or to Putin's friends to huge numbers of billions of dollars, that's important to know. The issue, and if the reports coming out of the dossier is correct, he was working with Russia during the election and during the hacking. Now, that's a very, very important thing to know. And so the issue is really what you might call a word that no one uses who thinks about it. The word begins with TR and ends with the word reason. And, and no one says it. And it's interesting, linguists know how to study this. We have to study both what people say and what people don't say. So you might say, how do you study what people are not saying? And this is, it's very important. Also, what they're negating. Notice when you negate someone, I wrote a book called Don't Think of an Elephant. It makes you think of an elephant. Nixon said, I am not a crook. It makes you think of a crook, right? But when you don't say something and you have it in your mind, what you do is circumlocution. You talk around it. You give words in related domains, but they're not quite there. You hedge. There's a list of things I studied and wrote the major paper on things like hedges, where you say, I think, I believe, maybe, you know, suppose this. There's a whole set of things where you have a central idea, but you hedge and you talk around it, right? We know how to study talking around a subject. And when you, then that's the subject that's being talked around a lot on TV. No one dares use that word because it's so powerful. But it's there. It's in the minds of people all over the place. And if you go online, you see the word everywhere. If there's a hashtag Trump treason, you know, the online, you put it on there and you'll get all the huge amounts of literature online. So this is the issue really isn't taxes. The issue is, what does he owe to Putin? And how would that, and to other people in other countries, to China, for example? He has huge loans in to China. You know, what does he owe to them?
I mean, to me, it's also a matter of how successful a businessman he is, because a lot of his supporters feel that he is a successful businessman, therefore he can maybe lead the country. But if it turns out his taxes show that he's a failed businessman because he may owe more than he actually earns, that would also be a big blow. You know, just would be interesting to see that.
But he also doesn't pay contractors who are, you know, part of the people who voted for him. But there's another really quite remarkable thing happening with this pay, who's going to pay for the wall issue. And he says, well, you know, we'll do it in some form. We'll pay up front, but they'll pay, but in another form. Well, what's the form that's being proposed? It's a tariff. It's a tax on imports. Now, if you think about it, he says, okay, we're going to collect the tax until it's $20 billion, enough to pay for the wall, right? And what that means is that, you know, we're going to have fewer imports, so there's going to be fewer things coming in from Mexico. Our balance of payments will be $20 billion less. And that's, so what that means is, if we're paying less, then we have more. You know, double negative, that's, you know, how you go into bankruptcy and make money. So the idea is that, now, if you actually did that, what would happen is that the American public would wind up paying more than Mexico. And the reason is, prices would go up. You have a tax on Mexican imports. They're going to, you know, the companies are going to raise prices. They're going to charge you more and maybe make a profit on it.
Well, George, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you. And we will post a link to your website from our site later today. Thanks so much.
Terrific. Thank you, Sonali. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. My guest is George Lakoff. You can find his work at georgelakoff.com, GeorgeLakoff.com. He's a professor in the graduate school at in cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Center for the Neural Mind and Society. He's written several books, including Don't Think of an Elephant, which was just republished. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/ruwithsonali.